This is edition number 1983 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 5th of September 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 4th of September, 2025. My name is Imogen Waterson, and my fellow readers are...
Merlin Waterson.
Hannah Stiff.
And Adrian Allenby.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 6:15 and will set at about 7:30.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes weather forecasting woes, a poignant poem, advances in spectacle technology and a visit to Book Corner.
But we begin with the main news items, which include a new threat to our eroding cliffs, council shake-up farce, ambulance strike threat and an alcohol-related death. Let's start with those lead stories.
A stretch of vulnerable coastline is facing a new nemesis as an invasive plant has begun to take hold. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, is battling against a growing Japanese knotweed problem at Overstrand's cliffs, which are at risk of falling into the sea. The authority is considering spending up to £120,000 to remove the harmful plant, which can cause damage to buildings due to its penetrating roots. In a report to Cabinet members, officers say addressing the issue is even more critical due to the environment of the cliffs, which are increasingly unstable. Recent landslips have meant that knotweed has fallen onto the seawall and it becomes very expensive to dispose of. The knotweed suppresses the growth of native species, which adds to the risk of erosion as it leaves the cliffs bare when it dies off, increasing the risk of water runoff destabilising the cliffs. Not taking action could delay plans to refurbish the sea defences in the area, and the council has also a legal obligation to remove a damaging weed. Various actions have been suggested to help keep it under control, which could include using herbicides containing glyphosate. Long term, the council intends to monitor how the weed reacts to the treatment, to help keep track of the infestation and prevent further spread. The eroding cliffs of Overstrand have led to NNDC closing the promenade for several months due to debris falling onto the walkway. The landslips have been blamed on the clay silt, gravel, chalk and sand materials that form the cliffs, which are naturally unstable and prone to slumping when wet. Urgent work is also needed to repair parts of the sea wall, which is essential to help protect the vulnerable coastline. NNDC's cabinet members will meet next week on September the 8th to discuss how to tackle Overstrand's Japanese knotweed problems.
Norfolk's council leaders have been left furious after government ministers failed to do their own analysis of the costs of the biggest upheaval of local government in 50 years. Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner claimed a significant amount of money would be saved by abolishing district councils in favour of single unitary authorities. But it has since been revealed that its estimates were based on an outdated 2020 report by the County Council Network, CCN, which claimed £2.9 billion could be saved over 5 years. District council leaders in Norfolk say they have been left astonished at the failure to conduct its own analysis. It means the government has not carried out an independent assessment and has instead relied on a report by CCN, whose members, including Norfolk County Council, are in favour of creating single mega councils. It's astonishing that the government has undertaken no independent analysis before embarking on the biggest organisation of councils for 50 years, said Sam Chapman Allen, leader of Breckland Council and chairman of the District Councils Network. Mega councils with populations of 500,000 people or more could be imposed on areas where there's no independent up-to-date evidence to justify councils of this size, and many large councils created previously are struggling financially. Tim Adams, leader of North Norfolk District Council, said, "Nothing in the government's approach is backed up by independent evidence and is reliant on partisan perspectives from county councils. This is moving the deck chairs into a smaller number of rooms while the ship still sinks because there are no fundamental public service reforms." The government insists the restructure will improve services and save taxpayers' money, and will make a decision on the reorganisation for Norfolk next year. Under Labour's local government reorganisation plans, all eight of Norfolk's councils would be abolished, and new unitary ones, which will provide all services to their population, would be created. Norwich, Broadland, Great Yarmouth, North Norfolk, Breckland and West Norfolk all favour three councils. Norfolk County Council would prefer one or two, while South Norfolk Council supports the idea of two. Norfolk's councils will submit their business case to the government next month. CCN has updated its analysis this year, which shows the proposed changes may deliver limited savings or none at all, and could in fact cost £850 million over the same period in certain scenarios. The latest findings suggest retaining the two-tier system in place in Norfolk and elsewhere would actually be more efficient than splitting the county up into multiple smaller unitary authorities. Researchers found unitary councils with populations as small as 300,000 will create hundreds of millions of new unsustainable costs for local taxpayers, Tim Oliver, chairman of the CCN, said. Its findings suggest a single unitary authority will be the option most likely to generate savings, whereas splitting the county into three councils is unlikely to produce any benefits. But district councils insist choosing one authority has not been proven to deliver savings, highlighting examples elsewhere in the country that have faced financial difficulties. This includes Somerset, which is currently undergoing a financial emergency, and North Yorkshire.
Ambulance workers in the region have threatened to go on strike because they fear a rota shake-up will break up crewmates. The East of England Ambulance Service Trust is considering introducing a team-based working rota system. This will see staff split up into individual teams with dedicated managers who will all work identical and fixed shifts. But crew members working for the trust fear the plans could break up long-standing working relationships and have threatened to take industrial action over them. The threat has sparked fears over patient safety should the strikes go ahead, with paramedics vowing to only attend calls that threaten life and limb. Ashley Foster, regional organiser of the GMB Union, said, "Our members are worried about the impact these changes could have on patient safety and their working relationships. We have explained our members' concerns to the Trust, but cannot force them to listen. Currently, workers are regularly paired with the same crewmate, with the union likening the relationships to tennis doubles partners." A worker said, "I've worked with the same crewmate almost every day for the last 10 years, and we know each other better than our partners at home. I know what my crewmate will do before they do it, and it's that level of trust and understanding that lets us work so efficiently. I've worked on the ambulance all my working life, but if this goes through, I'm done. The strike's threats have sparked fears over how already lengthy waits will be impacted if and when industrial action goes ahead. A spokeswoman for patient group Healthwatch Norfolk said, "We understand that the proposed changes to working practices will be a cause for concern for frontline staff, but we would urge all parties to consider the impact of possible strike action on patients at a time when the NHS is undergoing significant transformation and to take the necessary steps to limit any further pressure on the healthcare system." The changes which are yet to be introduced were proposed by the NHS Trust in response to concerns raised in the annual staff survey. In these results, workers called for greater support from their managers, who they said were infrequently sore due to differing shift patterns. Neil Maloney, Chief Executive of the Trust, said, "We understand the concerns raised by GMB and are committed to working closely with our staff and unions to get this right. Team-based working is being designed to better support our people, ensuring everyone has access to a compassionate manager and is part of a supportive, collaborative team. We are actively engaging with our people to shape this approach together, aiming to minimise disruption and preserve strong working relationships. Above all, patient safety remains our top priority. Any changes will be carefully planned to ensure we continue delivering the highest standard of care."
A man in his 40s had 8 referrals to alcohol support services in the space of 4 years before his death, an inquest has heard. Christian Jucker died from alcohol poisoning in March this year when he was 48 years old. An inquest into his death heard that Mr. Jucker, who lived in Blakeney near Holt, had a long history of struggles with alcohol dependency. The court heard these saw him referred to Change, Grow, Live, the charity which provides substance misuse support in the region on 8 occasions. However, on each of these occasions, between 2020 and 2024, his referrals were closed after he struggled to engage with the help on offer. A report from the charity read to the court stated, "During all treatments, he was offered assessment and offered support. He would then struggle to engage, and his referrals were closed on all occasions." The most recent interaction with the charity came on December the 9th, when he told support workers he had been abstinent from alcohol for 3 weeks. However, on March the 1st, his elderly mother found him collapsed on his bedroom floor and called for emergency services. He died at the scene. The medical cause of his death was confirmed as acute ethanol toxicity. In a statement read to the court, his sister said that despite his struggles, he was able to spend time volunteering in charity shops of the British Heart Foundation and the YMCA, where he made lots of friends. She said, "He was a kind, thoughtful son and brother who was loved and is missed." Yvonne Blake, area coroner for Norfolk, concluded he had died an alcohol-related death.
People living in North Norfolk may have recently spotted traffic counters and cameras on roadside verges. The equipment was installed as part of a study to look at the future of coastal roads as erosion continues to threaten communities in North Norfolk. Ed Maxfield, County Councillor for Munsley Division, said, "Proactive study of road use in the area and options for the future is something I first called for almost 8 years ago when I was first elected to the County Council. I am delighted this work is finally being done." Norfolk County Council said the surveys began in the week of August the 18th. automatic counters remained in place for 2 weeks, while about 50 video cameras were installed for 2 days across Cromer, North Walsham and Munsley. A spokesman said the cameras would identify travel patterns, but added that all data would be anonymised. The project is part of Coastwise, a DEFRA and Environment Agency funded scheme preparing North Norfolk communities for the impact of erosion.
Staff at a coffee shop on the North Norfolk coast have been left devastated after it was targeted by thieves overnight. They struck at the offshore coffee house on Sheringham's East Promenade during the early hours of Friday morning. A fair amount of cash was taken during the raid, which saw thieves ransack both the tip jar and a charity box full of money for the Hillside Shire Horse Sanctuary. A statement shared by the shop on social media reads, "We hope other businesses in the area weren't also targeted. Please spread the word to make sure everyone is vigilant." The cafe is urging anyone who might have seen the break-in to contact them. Norfolk Police have been contacted for comment.
A kayaker has been rescued after drifting out to sea off the Norfolk coast. The yellow kayak was seen drifting out to sea at about 3:30 p.m. on August the 28th in Walcott. RNLI Haysborough launched the D-class lifeboat Russell Pickering before travelling up the Bacton coast towards the kayaker's last known position. On their way, the crew contacted a wind farm vessel to ask if they could see the kayak. The vessel then confirmed that they could and that someone was still on board. Russell Pickering then headed to their position, arriving at 4:05 p.m. The kayaker was well but cold by the time the crew reached them. He was returned to the beach at Bacton by 4:27 p.m. before being greeted by his relatives and the Bacton Coast Guard. Chris Risby, a member of the lifeboat crew, said the casualty was over a mile offshore when picked up, 2.5 miles from the point of entering the water, travelling this distance in just 20 minutes. I urge people to please be aware of offshore winds and tides when on a kayak, paddleboard or boat. A day later, on August the 29th, Haysborough Lifeboat Station was visited by CEO of the RNLI, Peter Sparks, as well as the new head of region, Rebecca Felton.
A pair of paddleboarders were rescued a considerable distance off the coast of a Norfolk beach. On Saturday afternoon, two girls drifted out to sea in Sheringham shortly before lifeguards were due to finish for the day. A witness to the incident said the paddleboarders were around a mile out to sea and the lifeguard had to paddle a considerable distance to reach them. The lifeguard towed the girls back to shore on his own paddleboard. It is believed the girls were uninjured and no other emergency services were called to the scene.
Our next few news stories include failed plans for care home conversion, green light for a plastic waste plant, a banking hub for Holt, and concerns over Henry Blogg's boat.
A bid to turn a former care home into new housing has been thrown out by a government inspector following a planning appeal. Paul Bartholomew had hoped to convert the old rectory on Aylsham Road in Felmingham into 20 flats, later reducing the number to 16. North Norfolk District Council rejected the scheme last year, citing concerns over drainage, protected trees, and the possible presence of bats. The applicant appealed, but following a site visit by a planning inspector last month, the appeal has now been dismissed. In their report, the inspector said they were not satisfied the plans would avoid damage to trees on the site, some of which are covered by preservation orders. They also said ecological surveys had not been clear or detailed enough to rule out the risk to roosting bats. Other concerns included the potential impact on European protected sites from both recreational disturbance and nutrient enrichment, as well as inadequate detail about surface water drainage. The inspector also noted that no legal agreements had been provided to secure infrastructure or community contributions, which would normally be required for a development of this size. Felmingham Parish Council strongly opposed the scheme, raising particular concerns about sewage. With no piped main sewage provided by Anglian Water in the village, properties rely on their own soakaway and septic tank systems. In its objection, Felmingham Parish Council said, "Anglian Water has to supply a tankering service at least once a week to drain the waste material off-site as the plant is struggling to cope." Locals also objected over traffic, parking and drainage. One objection read, "Does the developer not realise the site does not have mains drainage? The cesspits would require emptying on a very regular basis, again requiring access for large vehicles. The old rectory had operated as a care home since 1981, but closed in 2019 after being rated inadequate in all areas by inspectors."
A shuttered bank branch in a market town could soon reopen after plans were lodged to transform it into a permanent banking hub. Cash Access UK has applied to convert the former Barclays building in Holt High Street. The site, on the corner with New Street, has stood vacant since the branch closed its doors in 2022, leaving the town without a bank. Under the proposals, the ground floor would be fitted out to provide counter services for all major banks. Customers would be able to withdraw and deposit cash, pay bills, check balances, and use change-giving services for small businesses. The old branch would also get a facelift outside. The plans include painting the frontage in black and grey, installing heritage-style signs with discreet lighting, and added frosted vinyl to the upper windows. At the back, new ventilation units would be fitted. The hub would employ 3 full-time staff and open Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Earlier this year, a temporary hub opened at the Venue Community Centre, but campaigners, including North Norfolk MP Stephan Aquarone, have long called for a more permanent solution. The MP previously said, "I have campaigned to bring banking hubs to North Norfolk for several years. They are essential for communities and allow residents and businesses to complete vital tasks like paying utility bills and topping up their gas and electricity locally, to allow them to talk to a real person from their own bank in confidence and in person." Banking hubs are owned by Cash Access UK and run by the Post Office. They aim to give people easy access to face-to-face banking in towns hit by branch closures. North Norfolk District Council is expected to make a decision regarding the application by October the 23rd.
A temporary plant that could help find new ways to deal with plastic waste has been approved at Scotto Enterprise Park. Swift Technology Group is building the trial facility, which uses a process called pyrolysis to break down plastics. The company was first granted permission in December 2023, but delays with specialist parts meant more time was needed. North Norfolk District Council has now agreed to extend the permission from 18 months to 2 years. However, the plant will still only be allowed to run for 60 days in total, 30 days for commissioning and 30 days for testing. Once completed, the equipment must be removed from the site and it returned to its previous state. Most of the plant will sit inside Hangar 2 at the former RAF Coltishall base, although some machinery and storage will be placed outside. The test will use a small supply of plastics bought in especially for the trial, not household waste. The council has set strict conditions. Lorry movements will be limited, vehicles must follow agreed routes, and hours of work will be controlled to reduce noise and disruption. In its decision, the council stressed that the project is temporary. A permanent plant would need a completely separate application and assessment. Pyrolysis is a way of breaking down materials by heating them in a container with very little oxygen. Because there is no oxygen, the plastics do not burn. Instead, they break down into oil and gases that can be reused. Unlike incineration, there is no tall chimney releasing smoke. Supporters say the process could help recycle difficult plastics, such as bags, cups and packaging, which usually cannot be dealt with by normal recycling methods. The council gave its approval on August the 28th.
A boat once used by Cromer's most famous son, lifeboat legend Henry Blogg, is at the centre of a row after claims it is being left to deteriorate in a town park. The QJ&J, a crab boat Mr. Blogg worked from in the 1930s, was installed next to his bust on North Lodge Park in 2016. Named after Blogg's children, Queenie and Jack, and his nephew Jim, it was hailed as a fitting tribute to one of the RNLI's most decorated lifeboatmen. The decade-long campaign saw a team of volunteers work to preserve the front section of the boat at the Museum of the Broads in Stalham. The boat was found to be in such poor condition that it had to be cut in half, and some of its pieces were sold to raise funds. The museum carried out the work for free, with the QJ&J Rescue Group raising thousands to fund the required materials. But 9 years later, concerns are growing over its condition. Tim Adams, leader of North Norfolk District Council and a member of Cromer Town Council, said it is deteriorating despite the huge effort of the community to get it back. Minutes from Cromer Town Council meetings reveal repeated difficulties in finding contractors willing to carry out basic maintenance on the boat and the other town assets. Despite advertising the work, no firms came forward. The council is now looking to the probation service to see if community payback teams can take it on. Councillor Richard Williams said, "It raises some questions why contractors are not willing to work with Cromer Town Council. The dispute has added to tensions between the district and town councils, with accusations of neglect extending to planters outside Cromer Museum and even the war memorial."
A former Methodist church close to a North Norfolk beach is on the market for £140,000, but certain conditions apply. Agents Arnold Keyes described the building at Weybourne near Holt as a unique property in the heart of the village. They add, "The property offers the opportunity for those wishing to use the site for a community facility, local service, or longer-term redevelopment of the site subject to planning. The building is classed as a community facility, and planning policies seek to avoid the loss of such sites. But the agents add a change of use may be considered if it can be shown community use is no longer viable, as long as the property has been offered for sale as a community facility for at least a year. The church is sited off Church Street, around half a mile from the beach. It was built in 1904 as the Methodist School Hall. It is constructed of brick under a clay tile roof, with later extensions to the side and rear, which have fibreglass flat roofs."
A charity camper van is taking to the road to deliver financial advice directly to people's doorsteps. Caring Together charity will tour Norfolk from Sunday, September the 8th, to Wednesday, September the 11th, offering free support to families where someone is disabled or living with a long-term illness. The service is part of the charity's Carer Money Matters project, which helps unpaid carers and their families manage financial pressures. Claire Rogers, project worker at Caring Together, said, "We know that it can be difficult to visit somewhere to get help if you live in a rural area, so we are coming to you. Anyone can just pop along for some advice and help. There's no need to book. Unpaid carers often struggle financially. They may have additional costs due to needing someone to keep the home warm for someone who is ill, or transport costs to hospital. The camper van will visit towns including North Walsham, Downham Market and Thetford. Caring Together supports people across Norfolk, Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. Visitors may also be eligible to collect free carbon monoxide alarms. The full schedule is available at caringtogether, all one word, .org.
Staff from a Norfolk-based home builder have helped tidy a seaside town. Workers from Barrett and David Wilson Homes, Anglia, took a break from their desks to pick litter up in Cromer. The initiative saw 16 team members, including managing director Simon Wood, collect 20 bags of rubbish in one day. The group rounded off the day with a fish and chip lunch on the seafront. Mr. Wood said, "We're incredibly proud of our team of volunteers who gave up their time to help keep Cromer looking at its best, while contributing to a cleaner, greener and healthier environment. Their efforts reflect our ongoing commitment as a company to environmental responsibility and to supporting the communities." A 2024 survey by Keep Britain Tidy found that fewer than 10% of locations in England are litter-free. More than 77% of people believe their country's litter problem has worsened in recent years.
A major milestone has been reached in the construction of 23 new affordable homes on the North Norfolk coast. The Sandpipers development on Ostend Road, Walcott, has now reached its highest point, a stage traditionally marked by a topping out ceremony. The homes being built by Flagship Homes are due to be completed by January 2026 and will be allocated to local families on the Council Housing Register. Stephen Jones, Senior Project Manager of Flagship, said, "Reaching this stage is a big moment for the team. The build has been going really well and we've had some great feedback already about the quality of the kitchens and the homes in general. We're proud to be creating warm, energy-efficient houses that will make a real difference for people in the local community." Construction manager Kyle Crush said, "The attention to detail from the start is paying off. We've had lots of positive comments from visitors to the site. The homes will be let at 80% of market value."
You are listening to edition number 1983 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 5th of September 2025. Still to come, there are some items about buckets of fun and basset hounds, and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, this week's obituaries.
David Richard Cully. It is with great sadness that we announce the unexpected passing of David at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital on August the 14th, 2025, aged 77 years. Dearly loved husband of Elizabeth, dad to Paul and Stephen, son of Elsie and brother of Joan, loving brother-in-law and uncle to all the family. Funeral service will be held at Cromer Crematorium on Friday, October the 3rd at 2025 at 12 noon. Wearing black is not essential. Immediate family flowers only, please, but donations welcomed to the Royal British Legion Halsey House at Cromer, care of Blythe & Sons Limited, 4 Cromer Street, Sheringham, NR268DZ.
Elizabeth Ann Smith, née Reynolds, passed away peacefully at Goodwin's Hall Care Home on Wednesday, August the 20th, 2025, age 73. Much loved wife of Pete, deceased, and a mother, sister, nanny and great-nanny. Funeral service at Mintlin Crematorium on Thursday, September the 11th, 2025, at 1 p.m. Family flowers only, please. Donations, if desired, for Norfolk and Waveney Mind or Action for ME may be made online via www.tfs.co.uk/obituary. Thornalley Funeral Services, Austin Street, King's Lynn, PE30 1QH.
And now some local events. On Sunday, the 7th of September, from 11 a.m, Fawnsett Steam Museum is hosting 16 of the largest steam engines. Prices start at £10. Located at the Fawnsett Industrial Steam Museum, Low Road, Fawnsett St Mary. On Tuesday, the 9th of September, from 6 p.m, you can walk the historic King's Lynn Town Wall defences while learning about their part in the English Civil War. Starting at St Anne's Fort, King's Lynn, contact 07948 667 641. On Thursday the 11th and Friday the 12th of September, the Wind Energy Museum will be open from 10:30 a.m. Prices from £5 to £23. Located at the museum, Reps with Bastwick. Visit the Forum in Norwich for a free 10-day exhibition and event series from Friday the 12th to Sunday the 21st of September, presented by the Forum and the American Library. A programme of free talks, guided city walks and exhibition tours will also take place, highlighting the lasting impact and legacy of the United States Army Air Forces across Norfolk.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear why weather forecasters don't always get it right, step back in time with a poignant poem, investigate autofocus spectacles, and make our monthly visit to Book Corner.
Start with Carol Kirkwood as she explains why weather forecasters often appear to get it wrong. This article was published on the BBC News website on the 6th of August 2025. Sometimes I'll be walking around a supermarket and a shopper will approach me in the aisle. I hosted a barbecue on Saturday and you told me it was going to rain, they will say, and it didn't. Why did you get it wrong? Or the opposite. They planned for a day of sunshine, only to be disappointed by grey skies. Or a parent might ask me in March what the weather might be like for their son's wedding in September. Those people are always delightfully friendly, and the conversations are part of what makes presenting the weather, which I've been doing for the last 3 decades, such a joy. Over my career, forecasting has improved almost beyond recognition. We can now predict the weather with much higher accuracy and in more granular detail than when I began presenting in the mid-1990s. Liz Bentley, a professor of meteorology at Reading University and chief executive of the Royal Meteorological Society, says that a one-day forecast is now correct in over 90% of the time. But despite those strides, there are still gaps in public trust. When YouGov asked British adults last summer whether they trusted the weather forecast, a substantial minority, 37%, said they didn't trust it very much at all. Jokes about the forecast are widespread. The 2012 Olympics opening ceremony included a clip of the moment from 1987 when the weather forecaster Michael Fish told viewers not to worry because there wouldn't be a hurricane, only for a devastating storm to hit hours later. Do we really get it wrong, or is something more complicated at play around how we share forecasts? Part of the challenge is around expectations, which have risen in our world of round-the-clock access to information. Another part of the challenge is how the wealth of information is boiled down and communicated. Meteorology produces an overwhelming amount of data. It's difficult to condense it into a snappy TV or digital app-friendly prediction. It means that even when we are technically correct, some viewers might still end up confused. But the answer also lies in the tricky nature of meteorology. It's a delicate science, and any tiny inaccuracy in the data can skew things or knock it out of shape. Every day across the British Isles, forecasters collect observations or data on things like temperature and wind speed through a network of more than 200 weather stations run by the Met Office. The data is then plugged into mathematical models run by powerful machines or supercomputers. Earlier this year, the Met Office unveiled a new supercomputer, switching for the first time from a physical machine to cloud-based software. The new device will deliver better forecasts and help scientists advance important climate research around the world, the Met Office says. But as with any science, there are weaknesses. The atmosphere is known as a chaotic system, meaning that a slight error, even as small as 0.1 degree centigrade in the initial observation, can produce a drastically different result. There's also a particular challenge when predicting the weather over small geographic areas. In the 1990s, a weather event needed to be larger than about 100 miles before it could be fully observed. Now, the UK weather model is used by the Met Office can map weather events as small as 2 miles, Professor Bentley says. But zooming in beyond that size remains difficult. So predicting weather like heavy fog, which might affect only a 1 kilometre space, is particularly tricky. It's easy to forget that forecasting is just that, predicting. Perhaps one day, when a mother asks me to predict weather at her son's wedding 6 months from now, I might be able to give a slightly better answer.
For our next article, we look back to a time and an area that is in the headlines today, as it is once again embroiled in conflict. The charge of the Light Brigade took place on October the 25th, 1854, during the Battle of Balaclava in the Crimean War. This famous but disastrous military action saw British light cavalry charge into a well-defended Russian artillery position, resulting in significant casualties and becoming a symbol of military incompetence and heroic courage. The poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, 1809 to 1892, immortalised the battle in the following poem entitled The Charge of the Light Brigade. Half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, charge to the guns, he said, into the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew, someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die, into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Flashed all their sabres bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabring the gunners there, charging an army, while all the world wondered. Plunged in the battery smoke, right through the line they broke. Cossack and Russian reeled from the sabre stroke, shattered and sundered. Then they rode back, but not the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon behind them, volleyed and thundered, stormed at with shot and shell, while horse and hero fell. They that had fought so well came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell, all that was left of them, left of 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honour the charge they made, honour the light brigade, noble 600. Not to detract from the power of Tennyson's poem, but history records that the charge involved 673 cavalrymen. 113 British soldiers were killed and 134 were wounded. Approximately 475 horses were also killed or had to be euthanised. There isn't a single Charge of the Light Brigade memorial. Instead, there are many memorials and commemorations across the UK for the soldiers and horses involved, including plaques, graves, and even a horse memorial for Sir Briggs, a survivor.
Next, we hear from technology reporter Chris Baranouk as he investigates autofocus spectacles. This article was published on the BBC News website on the 11th of July 2025. They look like an ordinary pair of glasses, but these are technology-packed specs. Nico Eden, chief executive of Finnish eyewear firm IXI, showed me the frames with lenses containing liquid crystals, meaning their vision-correcting properties can change on the fly. This one pair could correct the vision of someone who normally uses totally different pairs of glasses for seeing near or far. These liquid crystals can be rotated with an electrical field, explains Mr. Eden. The position of those crystals affects the passage of light through the lenses. A built-in eye tracker allows the glasses to respond to whatever correction the wearer needs at a given moment. However, tech-laden eyewear has a troubled history. Consumer acceptability is key, acknowledges Mr. Eden. Most people don't want to look like cyborgs. We need our products to look like existing eyewear. Pressphobia, an eye-related condition that makes it harder to focus on things close to you, is projected to become more common over time as the world's population ages, and myopia, or short-sightedness, is also on the rise. Spectacles have remained largely the same for decades, with bifocal and varifocal lenses, a relatively recent progression. Autofocus lenses now promise to adjust part of all the lens spontaneously and even accommodate the wearer's changing eyesight. Our latest lenses have proved promising in test, says Mr. Eden. Participants in the company's trials have been asked, for example, to read something on a page, then look at an object in the distance to see whether the glasses respond smoothly to the transition. Mr. Eden says that the eye-tracking device within the spectacles cannot determine exactly what a wearer is looking at, though certain activities, such as reading, are in principle detectable because of the nature of the eye movements associated with them. Since such glasses respond so closely to the wearer's eye behaviour, it is important the frames fit well, says Amelia Heelin, product director. The small battery secreted inside IXI's autofocus frames should last for 2 days, says Mr. Eden, adding that it's possible to recharge the specs overnight while the wearer is asleep. But he won't be drawn on a launch date, which he intends to reveal later in 2025. As for cost, I ask whether £1,000 might be the sort of price tag he has in mind. He merely says, "I'm smiling when you say it, but I won't confirm." Autofocus lenses could help people who struggle with varifocals or bifocals, says Paramdeep Bukha, clinical advisor at the College of Optometrics. However, he adds, there is insufficient evidence to state whether they perform as well as traditional options and whether they can be used for safety-critical tasks such as driving. Professor To, an optometry researcher at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, has a similar concern. What if the vision correction went wrong or was delayed slightly while he was performing surgery? But I think in terms of general use, having something that allows autofocusing is a good idea, he adds. Mr. Eden notes that the first version of his company's lenses will not alter the entire lens area. One can always glance over the dynamic area, he says. If wholly self-adjusting lenses emerge, then safety will become a much more serious business. Back in Hong Kong, Professor To has developed lenses that have a honeycomb-like ring in them. Light passes through the centre of the ring, focused as normal, reaches the wearer's retina and allows them to see clearly. However, light passing through the honeycomb part is defocused slightly, meaning that the retina gets a slightly blurred image. This appears to slow improper eyeball growth in children, with Professor To says cuts the rate of slight shortedness progression by 60%. Glasses with this technology are now in use in more than 30 countries, he adds. While autofocus glasses and other high-tech solutions may have promise, Professor To has an even bigger goal. Glasses that don't just slow down myopia, but actually reverse it slightly.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, let's find out what the Mardler's resident librarian, Lorna, has found in Book Corner. Many of us love to be totally engrossed in the pages of a novel. The longer, the better. However, short stories offer concentrated bursts of entertainment and literary variety without the time commitment of a novel. Each story is quick to read, easily digestible and action-packed. So this month we have chosen some collection of short stories with interesting titles to tempt you. The first book we have selected is a tasty crime fiction collection, Beggar's Banquet by Ian Rankin. Over the years, Ian Rankin amassed an incredible portfolio of short stories, all bearing the hallmark of his great crime writing. This collection of 21 stories ranges from the macabre to the unfortunate and right back to the sinister. It even features 8 stories about TV detective Inspector Rebus. Many of the stories are very fast reads, such as the macabre hitman tale in which the antagonist gets more than he bargained for. There are stories with social commentary, such as the one entitled The Glimmer. There are even some unusual tales, including Video Nasty, which is a surreal first-person narrative. And now for something completely different, with Cheating at Canasta by William Trevor. This book explores the themes of missed opportunities, the inevitability of change, and the powerful, albeit fragmentary, quality of our memories. The 12 stories are beautifully written, and their messages are profound. In the title story, a man sits in a bar in Venice thinking of his wife. Amongst the pages, you might enjoy the Irish country tale of mystery, destiny, and ambivalence. Or what happens when we encounter a young man trying to squeeze a few extra euros from Spanish tourists. Each one of the stories in this book is touchingly told. If you enjoy the sport of people watching, you might like Binocular Vision by Edith Perlman. This epic collection of tales offers 17 hours of interesting listening themed around the predicaments of being human. These diverse tales capture life in all its complexities, complete with all its dilemmas. Scenarios include an unforeseen love affair, an elderly couple's decision to shoplift, and a deathbed confession. They are crafted with imagination, compassion, lucidity, and humour. Moving swiftly from the human race to something more otherworldly, we bring you 6 sensational science fiction stories in Atomic Tales. BBC Audio presents this collection of fantastic tales of twisted futures and times beyond tomorrow, set in 1950s America. In these perfectly pitched parodies, we encounter Venusian terrorists in Their Gaze Was Green. Consider the future of food in Land of Plenty, and meet giant man-eating bugs in Night of the Cicadas. It's white-knuckle time. Will the heroes save the day, or is this the end for mankind? The Greek myths are considered to be amongst the greatest stories ever told. They have been passed down through millennia, inspiring writers and artists such as Shakespeare, Michelangelo, and even Walt Disney. So the final book we have chosen this month is Mythos by Stephen Fry. In Stephen Fry's hands, the stories of the Titans and gods become brilliantly entertaining accounts of ribaldry and revelry, warfare and worship, love affairs and life lessons, triumphs and tragedies. You'll fall in love with Zeus and weep with King Midas. Mythos captures these stories perfectly for the modern age. They are spellbinding, informative, and moving. We hope you are tempted to read some of these books. You can listen to all of them from Calibre Audio Library on Memory Stick, on the internet, or using Alexa. You can also borrow or request these audiobooks or listen to them on the internet from Norfolk County Libraries.
items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles includes an 11-mile swim, Macbeth in a tempest, fine dining in Stalham, and wildlife-friendly gardening.
A determined woman from Cromer is preparing to take on an 11-mile swim. Claire McCarthy plans to swim the length of Lake Windermere in the Lake District as part of the Chill Swim Triple Crown, which includes three long-distance lake swims. The 58-year-old, who was born with albinism and is severely sight-impaired, has already completed the 5.25-mile Coniston Water and the 7.5-mile Ullswater swims. Ms. McCarthy said, "This is a huge challenge for me. The longest swim I have ever undertaken by a big margin. I have always liked swimming, and being in a pool, I am guided by the markings in the pool and the fact that after 25 metres you get to the end. Swimming that kind of distance, especially in wild water, is akin to running a marathon, and it's a big challenge, but I am determined to do it." She is raising funds for Vision Norfolk and Guide Dogs UK. Last year, Ms. McCarthy completed the Coniston Chill Swim, raising £4,400 for the two charities. She took on the triple challenge this year after learning about Vision Norfolk's 220 challenge, which aims to raise £220,000 in 12 months, to mark the charity's 220th anniversary. Andrew Mortar, Chief Executive of Vision Norfolk, praised her efforts. He said, "I never fail to be amazed at what people living with sight loss can achieve, and Claire's determination and commitment is a really good example of this. This is a really big challenge, and we are especially grateful that she has chosen Vision Norfolk as one of the two charities she will be supporting with her efforts." Ms. McCarthy has been training at the Reef Leisure Centre in Sheringham with coach Karen Ricks from the Tri Anglia Triathlon Club. Donations can be made at justgiving.com.
What an evening of contrasts we had to watch one of Shakespeare's classics. The venue for the open-air performance was the simply stunning, beautifully peaceful South Lawn overlooking the lake at Walterton Hall in North Norfolk, which has only recently been reopened to the public for the first time in decades. After a day of aptly named Tempest Weather, which the cast had to endure to put up the stage, the rain moved away in time for a pleasant late summer evening. The tranquillity of the fabulous location could not have been more contrasting to the murderous, powerful adaptation of Macbeth brought to life by the acclaimed Duke's Theatre Company. Directed by Robert Shaw Cameron, whose credits include Coronation Street and Regent's Park Open Air Theatre, and designed by Jessica Curtis, the production featured a cast of six actors delivering a gripping take on the classic play. The company produced a dynamic reimagining of the tragedy, with bold and innovative interpretations to the dark tale of ambition, killing, and madness. The set was simple, the performance was gritty with a contemporary twist, with the bard's timeless themes, and included a very funny interjection by the porter, who engaged delightfully with the audience. Macbeth was the final event of the summer at Walterton, which the hosts described as the best. It is certainly a fabulous place for outdoor theatre under a stretched tent, and we must hope that there will be much more to come in the future. My only regret is that we didn't witness the sight of Lady Macbeth, who we were told went hang gliding with the gazebo during an earlier storm.
A well-known restaurant in the Broads is preparing for a major relaunch with a fine dining focus and a Michelin-starred trained chef at the helm. Formerly the Mermaid Slipper, the eatery located on Staithe Road in Stalham is being rebranded as Restaurant 1812. The name marks the year the property was first built. During restoration work, the team uncovered an original kiln and flint walls, which have been incorporated into the redesign. Leading the kitchen is 35-year-old chef Lee Tyler, who trained under Gordon Ramsay and Simon Rogan at his Lake District restaurant L'Enclume, which holds three Michelin stars. The head chef most recently worked at Holt's Meadow Suite. Originally from Peterborough, but raised in Norfolk, he said, "We've tried to expose the character of the building again. It's such a lovely spot, perhaps one that gets forgotten about. With the museum and the boatyard nearby, it's a great place to be." The restaurant will serve tasting menus built around seasonal, locally sourced produce, including Wagyu beef from a nearby farm. Desserts will be made without refined sugar, using natural sweeteners such as honey to create indulgent but healthier dishes. Restaurant 1812 is owned by GP Dr. Julian Brown, founder of the health charity Health Amplifier, which supports diabetes patients. The restaurant will work with the charity to promote healthier eating and will also offset its carbon footprint through tree planting. Mr. Tyler said he hoped the project would inspire other young chefs to bring new life to empty buildings across the country. He said, "There are lots of buildings standing empty at the moment. I think young chefs should be looking at them and saying, maybe I can make a go of it. It takes hard work, but why not?" Restaurant 1812 will open in September and is currently recruiting staff.
Wildlife-friendly gardening has been celebrated for its role in supporting biodiversity. The Cromer Green Spaces Best Wildlife Garden competition recognised residents' efforts in creating habitats for nature at an award ceremony held at Halsey House. Tim Adams, leader of North Norfolk District Council, presented the awards across two categories. Stephanie Gilbert won the large garden category. Judges said, "The pond has a shallow shingle beach at one end to allow creatures ease of access or an escape route, and the number of wildflower species is high, providing nectar for a wide range of insects, with a number of them being food plants of butterfly and moth caterpillars." Jane and Trevor Williams won the small garden category. Judges praised their entry as an inspiration to anyone with a small space. Winners received Cromer Green Spaces plaques, sponsored and produced by Structure Flex Limited, and all entrants were given boxes of wildflower seeds. Organisers also thanked Halsey House, which partnered with Cromer Green Spaces to create a wildflower meadow in its grounds. The event concluded with volunteers scything the meadow.
Sheringham beachgoers were bemused by people in 1940s costumes. The site was not an early 1940s weekend or a film shoot, but the Cromer and Sheringham Operatic and Dramatic Society preparing for their play And Then There Were None. Agatha Christie's suspenseful mystery will be performed at Sheringham Little Theatre from October the 21st to the 25th. The story centres on a group of strangers lured to a secluded island mansion facing dire consequences. Director Nicola Gilbert said, "The play's sense of dread and tension will keep audiences on the edge of their seats and guessing to the very end." This is the Society's first time staging an Agatha Christie play. Theatregoers can now book tickets for the performance. Bookings can be made at sheringhamlittletheatre.com or via the box office on 01263 822 347. As the play contains some sensitive themes, an advisory age recommendation of 12 plus is in place. Further information is available on the theatre website. This production is expected to be popular, with the Society aiming to deliver a thrilling experience for fans of classic mystery.
Tickets have gone on sale for an illuminated outdoor trail at a National Trust estate. Garden of Lights returns to the Blickling estate near Aylsham from Saturday, December the 6th, to Sunday, December the 21st. The event runs from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. and the step-free route is approximately 2 miles long. As darkness falls, the gardens of Blickling Estate come alive with light and wonder. Visitors can explore creative illuminations and interactive moments set against the backdrop of the historic hall. There'll be mulled drinks, seasonal bites, and sweet treats to enjoy throughout the evening. Everyone, including National Trust members, will need to book tickets in advance for the event, as there will not be any tickets available on the day. This year, the event is introducing tiered ticket prices in three bands: off-peak, Monday to Thursday, peak, Fridays and Sundays, and super-peak, Saturdays. Adult tickets range in price between £16 and £24, with child tickets, 5 to 17, ranging between £9 and £13. Under fives go free, but still need a ticket booked.
The date of a town's last free car boot sale of the year has been announced. Organised by North Walsham Town Council, the final car boot sale of 2025 will take place on Sunday, September the 14th, between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. in the War Memorial Park. For buyers, regular parking is at the high school, with places available on the field for blue badge holders. The gates open at 8 a.m. for sellers, and there is no need to book, but traders are asked to contact info at northwalshamtc.gov.uk. While free, donations to the Mayor's charity are welcome.
A young seal pup is making a strong recovery after being rescued in poor health from a Norfolk beach. The two-month-old seal, named Leica, was found stranded at Cromer in a critical condition on August the 11th. She was suffering from multiple wounds, a high fever, and parasites. After emergency overnight treatment, she was taken to Sea Life Hunstanton's Seal Hospital, arriving at just 11 kilograms, well below the healthy weight for her age. Leica has since made steady progress under 24-hour care. Sophie Negus, assistant curator at Sea Life Hunstanton, said Leica has shown incredible resilience through her recovery. "She's a real fighter with bags of personality. Her progress has been tremendously encouraging, and we're counting down to the day when we can watch her return to where she truly belongs, the open sea." The centre's rehabilitation team aims to help Leica reach a release rate of 21 kilograms before she is returned to the wild this autumn. Sea Life Hunstanton reminded the public that while seals often rest on beaches, only those showing clear signs of distress or injury should be reported to the British Divers Marine Life Rescue.
Our last few articles cover crustaceans in Cromer, a barefoot druid, hounds in Holcombe, and wartime school days.
A seaside town was awash with colour, music and buckets of crustacean-themed fun as a popular festival auction event took place last weekend. Families flocked to the pier forecourt for a day of seaside fun at the Cromer Crab and Lobster Festival's auction day on Sunday. The World Pier Crabbing Championship took place in the morning before attention turned to the star attraction, the auction of this year's Art Trail treasure chests. The 2025 theme for the festival, which took place in May, was nautical chests. 59 local businesses each bought and decorated a wooden chest lovingly made by Cromer charity About With Friends. The group, which has partnered with the festival since it began in 2012, uses upcycled materials to create the blanks, giving members a chance to develop skills and play a central role in the town's biggest community event. Once in the hands of shops, cafes and businesses, the plain chests were transformed into works of art, with staff, customers and local artists all getting involved. For the first time this year, visitors were also asked to vote for their favourites, with winners announced during Sunday's auction. The lively sale was accompanied by the sounds of the shanty crew, the Blakeney Old Wild Rovers, food stalls, local crafts, and plenty of Cromer crab on the menu. Organisers said the event, which is run entirely by volunteers, continues to raise thousands of pounds for local good causes, while celebrating the town's seafaring heritage and world-famous seafood. Earlier in the year, the Cromer Crab and Lobster Festival's main weekend in May saw a host of free events with stalls, cookery demos, children's activities, seafood and live music. And for those already missing the fun, provisional dates for next year's Crab and Lobster Festival have been set for May the 15th to the 17th, 2026.
A druid on a cross-country pilgrimage took an unusual step on his quest when he played in a Norfolk tennis tournament in his bare feet. Ben Stutchbury, 23, originally from Rugby in Warwickshire, has just completed a summer-long journey from Western Wales to the most easterly point of England in Lowestoft. Travelling with his partner Louise Rowland, 36, the pair have been living in a caravan since setting off from St David's on June the 21st, the summer solstice. They called their project Intertwining Albion and spent weeks walking, meeting people, sharing music and celebrating nature along the way. But Mr. Stutchbury, a keen tennis player since the age of four, couldn't resist signing up for the Cromer Lawn Tennis Tournament when he reached the North Norfolk coast. And instead of wearing trainers, he decided to take things a step further by competing barefoot. "It was my first time playing without shoes, and it felt brilliant," he said. "I won my first match, which was a huge buzz, and though I lost in the next round, I still felt like a winner. Playing as a druid, barefoot, felt like I was representing myself properly." He added, "I believe being barefoot helps me to feel more connected to the earth. The energy moves through my body. My feet could spread out naturally, the way our ancestors would have done." His unusual playing style was helped along by the grass surface. "I think on clay or tarmac it might have been tougher," he admitted, "but grass cushions the shock. My partner was on the sidelines giving me recce support, which kept me going." Pilgrimage complete, the couple plan to return to West Wales, where Mr. Stutchbury hopes to combine his passions for music, painting and druidic practice with plenty more tennis, shoes optional.
The beach at Wells next the sea is usually home to seals and seabirds. But at the weekend, more than 300 basset hounds took over the seafront as part of the popular annual walking event. the Basset Hound Beach Invasion returned for its sixth iteration on August the 30th, with hundreds of dogs and owners walking from Wells Beach across to Holcombe. A total of 306 Basset Hounds arrived in North Norfolk from across the UK, along with the event's first ever international visitor from Germany. Tracy Ann Wright, who leads the event with her husband Matthew and their three hounds Boomer, Moose and Moleskine, described the event as a blur of excitement. She said, "Soon it became clear that we had beat the previous year's number, but we knew some may have been missed. Everyone was chatting, making new friends, finding family members from breeding lines. It was just incredible. We ran to the beach steps to start the count fresh, and we couldn't believe it when we hit 300. To finish at 306 was just mind-blowing." The event started unofficially with 12 hounds in 2012, but has exploded in popularity since then, almost doubling in numbers year on year. While the walk from the Wells Beach Cafe to the Lookout Cafe at Holcombe was the main event, four other waddles were also held at Holcombe Hall, Sandringham Estate, Heacham and Brancaster Beaches across the weekend. Mrs. Wright added, "I'm gobsmacked by its success and thankful to all those who chose to join us for the weekend. As ever, Norfolk locals and local businesses were incredibly warm and welcoming."
As children prepare to settle into a new school year, residents at a Norfolk care home have been looking back on their own early days in the classroom. Stan Parry, who resides at Heath Lodge in Holt, began his educational life in 1937 at an all-boys school and recalled having lessons that took place entirely in one classroom. The 97-year-old said, "We stayed in the same room all day and learned various subjects. I didn't have school dinners, just a packed lunch in a brown paper bag. Sometimes jam sandwiches, sometimes dripping. During the war, we only had meat once a week. In the playground, we played tag, or sometimes on the rooftop of the school. If we had a fallout with another boy, the teacher would put us in the boxing ring to sort it out." And once a week, Stan and his classmates would go to the local baths for swimming. It doubled as a laundry for the local women, who paid a shilling to wash clothes in the hot water, he added. Mary Butcher, who grew up opposite Holt Primary School on Valley Lane, has equally vivid memories of wartime school life. She said, "Every Friday, my mum would bake cakes and bring them over to the playground for me and my friends. We were always excited about that." The 93-year-old also spoke of how the war affected school life and added, "We only had half a week at school so that evacuees could take the other half of the week for lessons. We also had to carry gas masks every day just in case. School was different back then, but we had our fun. Even in tough times, there was always something to smile about." Hazel Madden, the general manager at Heath Lodge, was inspired by hearing the residents' memories of their school days. She said, "Listening to residents share their school memories reminds us how resilient and resourceful children were during those challenging times. It's wonderful to see them passing on their experiences with younger generations." The home runs a weekly cake and coffee afternoon every Wednesday from 2 p.m.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610. And that, as you will no doubt know, is me.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send out new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing was Chris Wilson. And producing this issue was Manny Gomes. But keep listening, as immediately following this edition of The Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello and welcome to your regular quiz section. My name is Anne and I have five short questions for you. So if you're ready, we'll begin, and this is quiz number 36. And question one is, who discovered that the Earth revolves around the Sun? Question 2. What art form is described as decorative handwriting or handwritten lettering? Question 3. Which planet has the most moons? Question 4. Which country has won the most World Cups? And question 5. Complete the following lyrics. I should have changed that stupid lock. And that's all for this quiz. I'll speak to you again soon when I bring you the answers. Hello again, this is Anne with your regular quiz section, and I have the answers for you to quiz number 36. Question 1 was, who discovered that the Earth revolves around the Sun? Well, that was Nicholas Copernicus. Question 2 was, what art form is described as decorative handwriting or handwritten lettering? This is calligraphy. Question 3, which planet has the most moons? Saturn. Question 4, which country has won the most World Cups? This was Brazil. And question 5 was, complete the following lyrics. I should have changed that stupid lock. The answer is, I should have made you leave your key. All words to the song I Will Survive. And that's all for this time. I'll speak to you again soon when I bring you the next quiz.
Hello again, it's Liz from East Kilbride here. Now, this woman that I'm going to try and talk about to you, well, really, I think I need a mini-series for her. Because she had the most astonishing life. In fact, the life became so astonishing to me as I was trying to clarify what exactly she did and when, that it became impossible to believe it was true. But it really is. And here's a wee way of referring to the screen goddess, Hedy Lamarr. How about beauty, brains, and bad judgment? Well, let's see what she actually lived during her life. Very significantly, she was born in Austria and her name was Hedvig Eva, as her first names, and she was of a Jewish European background, and that mattered quite a bit as she lived her glamorous life. Her beauty and adoration of performing led her, even as a teenager, to want to be involved in the wonder world of making movies in Vienna. So she began as an extra and running errands and all the rest of it. And then, whether she was, you know, very, very young in her ways, or maybe things weren't explained to her properly, her first film was, shall we say, rather racy. She later claimed that the director had not explained that she would be taking her clothes off. Anyway, the film was called Ecstasy. It was a sensation, and then it was banned, and then her parents were upset, and then she was upset. And another item was that the third richest man in Austria, a munitions manufacturer, decided that this glorious woman should be his bride. And while still a teenager, our gal married Fritz Mandl. He was 15 years older than her, immensely powerful and immensely controlling of our gal. She did, in fact, in the years married to Mandl, sit in on his business meetings. He made munitions. At these meetings, they talked technology. They talked about new engineering ideas. She had a basic interest and knowledge in engineering from her childhood. And this perhaps gave her the idea of something she could do if she could escape the marriage. So she did. She managed to persuade Mandl one evening that she should wear all her jewellery to a particular event. And then she went to the event, somehow smuggled herself out disguised as a maid. There are various wee different versions of this story. And the main result was that she fled Austria and came to London. She had already decided a career in the movies was her path to an independent future. She managed to get herself a berth on the Normandy that was sailing to New York, and just happened to meet several times on that cruise over to the States one Louis B. Mayer, one of the all-time great fixers of 1930s American Hollywood cinema. He said to her, "Well, come to America. You will be a star." She was an exquisite beauty. Everyone decided that. "But your name's not right." And as a gesture to an old silent movie actress, she was given the name Hedy Lamarr. So now you know who really I'm talking about. She went on to be one of the most successful imports of European actors into the movie industry, starring with all-time greats Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, James Stewart. She also perhaps showed this bad judgment now and again that I mentioned earlier. She turned down the lead part in Casablanca that later went to Ingrid Bergman. Her reaction when it became a worldwide success, Hedy said, "Ouch." I think that's an understatement. She was meeting different men and having different affairs, or small flings, as she might have called them. And one of these flings was with the very odd and very wealthy man, Howard Hughes, who was also involved in financing movies. He was obsessed with aviation, streamlining, and that was what they spoke about. They were both passionately interested in aviation and the new technology. So when the fling faded, he still supplied endless chemistry sets to her, scientific sets to Hedy. She was bored just being a screen goddess. I know, you can hardly believe this. But when she wasn't on the screen, she was in her movie trailer doing research, studying new methods of technology, and above all, somehow she crossed a path with a man called George Antheil, who was also a Jewish emigre into the States. By this time, we're talking the late 30s. They both knew what Nazism would be coming their way. They both wanted to contribute to the war effort. So these two souls who had come from Europe to escape from some of the horrors decided, what could they do? And she wanted to be so much more than just the actress who was the glamour woman on the screen. So these two people sat together and, believe it or not, they crafted a radio-controlled torpedo by really all about hopping the spectrum. I can't go into the science. To me, it's right up there with space travel, but I'm doing my best for you. The basic thing is that they could stop the torpedoes sinking the ships. They could put the torpedoes off course. So this was a huge contribution to the Allied war effort. In fact, it was so advanced for its time, it wasn't fully understood until the 1950s. This invention, crafted by our star, Hedy Lamarr, and her friend George Antheil, was in fact the basis of all modern communications technology. She is sometimes called the mother of Wi-Fi. She wanted to pursue this. She wanted to come to Washington and work with fellow inventors in the war effort. And a man from the War Office in America said to her, "No, no, Hedy, go back. You're worth far more selling kisses so that people buy war bonds to raise money for the American effort." So that's what she did. This invention and her passion for inventing remained hidden. It didn't fit with the image of a goddess on the screen. And she did go back to the war effort, and she did sell kisses till the end of the war. What can I tell you about her personal life? Well, she had six marriages. Her words about marriages are, as you might understand, rather powerful, being a woman of all these experiences. She said famously, "Men are fine. Love, it's fine. It's marriage that I'm a little disappointed in." Maybe the men were wrong, or maybe Hedy wasn't the marrying type, but she kept trying. Another of her words: "The wedding ceremony took 6 minutes. The marriage lasted about the same amount of time, though the divorce took over a year." She did try, as I said. Some of them lasted longer than others. One of them, in fact, the final marriage, was to a divorce lawyer. It's almost as if she knew this one might not last. But because they were so short-lived, in fact, by the age of her 53, the six marriages were all over, and she decided, "No more marriage for me," and she lived the rest of her life as an independent woman. Did she forget about her home country of Austria? Never. She, in fact, she was skiing, I think it was husband number 5, and they were skiing in Colorado. And she thought that the mountains around Aspen in Colorado would make a beautiful skiing resort. That area reminded her of the hills of Austria. And she started a resort there. They called it Villa Lamarr, and it became a very successful resort and a very elite resort where many of the beautiful people from Hollywood would go for their skiing. Villa La Mar, sadly, was lost by Hedy in the deal at the end of marriage number 5. In her later career, as perhaps her glorious beauty was fading, she started to run her own production companies, taking control of the films and appearing in them as well. But sadly, the films were not a success and in fact drained her financially. And again, in her later years, what do you do when your great beauty starts to fade? And Hedy Lamarr, by the 1960s, has become almost a recluse. She has resorted to cosmetic surgery in the early days, sadly, and some of the surgery was botched. And instead of aging beautifully as she would have done, her face is actually scarred by the surgery. And all these links to Austria, the Austria of her homeland, never leave her. She decides to keep those links by always celebrating the skiing of Austria, by asking that her ashes should be scattered in the Vienna woods, and even saying that to many people that one of her villas in Austria, in her days of great money and wealth post-war, had been used by the von Trapp family and again was used as one of the locations in the very famous film The Sound of Music. So Hedy Lamarr, what an astonishing life. A woman who said perhaps that marriage wasn't enough, that even being a successful actress wasn't enough, who was told to sell kisses before following her scientific dream. And I think I would like to leave you with perhaps more kind words about Hedy Lamarr. Magnetism with warmth. And by the way, of such exquisite beauty that most of the historians reckon that Hedy Lamarr was the model for the original Walt Disney movie, Snow White. So I suppose in that way, she has stayed immortal and her young looks are there forever for us to enjoy up there in the silver screen. Thanks so much and take care of yourselves.
TNF Soundings.